Our topic today is a man who is often quoted, sometimes correctly, sometimes incorrectly, sometimes in context, sometimes not. But few have actually read his works in full. And even when you do that, getting to know the actual man behind his ideas and how they came about can be even more difficult. We brought on today for the full hour just a great guest to help us peel a few layers back on Carl. Our guest will be Donald Stoker. He's the author of the new book, Clausewitz, His Life and Work. He is a professor of strategy and policy at the U.S. Naval War Colleges program at the Naval Postgraduate School in beautiful Monterey, California. This is his second book. His previous book was The Grand Design, Strategy in the U.S. Civil War. That won the Fletcher Pratt Award for Best Nonfiction Civil War Book of 2010. Not a runaround everyday award. Past winners include both Bruce Canton and also Shelby Foote. Don, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me.
Really appreciate it, and I definitely appreciate you taking time on this Sunday to come spend some time with us. Just to kind of set the foundation, I'm pretty confident in saying almost all of our listeners probably quote Clausewitz a few times themselves, but there may be some out there who maybe don't have much of a knowledge of Carl, and we'll dig into the details as the course of the show goes along. But just in real broad term, who was Carl von Clausewitz? When did he live? Which nations did he serve? And what was the major defining event that helped form his views?
Well, he was born in Prussia in 1780, and Prussia is, of course, the country that eventually unites Germany. And when Clausewitz was born, you know, of course, you know, Germany is a geographical expression, you'll usually hear historians call it at that time, because it's dozens of different countries, and Prussia and the Austro-Hungarian Empire being the dominant German states. And he goes into the Prussian army as a child. His father was a Prussian officer, you know, as well. And he dies in 1831. He's one of the victims of the great cholera epidemic that sweeps across Europe during that time, and kills some other famous people like Goethe, the writer, and some others as well. And he spends his entire life as a soldier, most of the time in the Prussian army, but for a couple of years as a member of the Russian army, which is not unusual during this period. Professional soldiers would often move from army to army. Clausewitz writes one time about one of his friends who had managed to fight in almost every campaign in the Napoleonic period and in almost a different army almost every time. So and it's from this experience that he certainly draws a lot of his lessons. But what he thought was that one of the key experiences for him were two things that in his mind were the most important for his own development and development of his ideas. Is one, the French Revolution and what happens there, and the upheaval and the change in the methods and the intensity of warfare and the unleashing of the passions of the people and the harnessing of the people for war. He considered that really critical in his own development. And also another critical thing was man, it was his mentor and kind of a substitute father as well, and his boss for much of his career, a German officer named, Prussian officer named Scharnhorst, who was very instrumental in reforming the Prussian army and developing the educational system for Prussian officers. And Scharnhorst's method of analysis of just rigorous historical study, really clear approaches, understanding what you are looking at and what is the foundation for your arguments, and just ruthlessly parsing the things that didn't make sense. This also, for Clausewitz, was really critical, and which is what he says.
When you one of the things as I'm reading through the book is that you have laid out the context for a background in Clausewitz most of us would not be familiar with. Can you kind of talk about what your intent was in going through the fact that he was, as it turns out, quite the combat experienced officer, and how that, to finish the rest of your book for you, how that led to some of his ideas, where his thought processes came from?
Well, one of the things that I wanted to do a little differently was, you know, when most of the stuff written about Clausewitz is written about his theories, which is obviously makes sense because that is what, you know, what he's known for and what he is most, why is important, obviously. But I wanted to put him in the muck because, and just to see, you know, what really did he live through with this? And is there, in drawing lessons from this that we could, or drawing connections from his military experience directly to his theories, I think is difficult, you know, really difficult to pick like one particular example and then say, oh, this appears in On War, and so therefore it comes from this. I think that would be, it's just about impossible because he never says that, that I found where he actually draws the experience that way. But I think by learning from his experience or understanding his experience, it, I think it makes his ideas, makes us take his ideas more seriously. And I say that because, you know, teaching, trying to teach some of his, we kind of cherry pick On War a little bit to teach, you know, strategic thinking and teach critical analysis. But I think sometimes my students are very interested in his ideas. My students are mostly 03, 04 officers, but sometimes they're not very interested in it because, or maybe skeptical, and maybe a healthy skepticism is a way to put it, because you've got this guy, oh, this ethereal theory is in their mind. Why should I take this guy seriously? He's just some another professor like me, you know, giving them this idea, or maybe they know he was an officer, or maybe they know he was a general, but so what? You know, there are a lot of generals. But one thing I found is that it for certain students, demonstrating to them the amount of military experience he had and the intensity of it, and, you know, I can place him at 36 battles, small and large, whether how his involvement in each of them is difficult to decipher from action to action, but some of them he's wounded in one of them, so you're certainly involved if you take a bayonet to the side of the head, you know, so he's got some credit, that gives him a little more credibility with some of the students, I think, and, you know, because some of the students I have, particularly the Army and Marine Corps students I have, you know, I remember asking one of my Army students how many times he had been to Afghanistan. He said, I don't know, sir, 9 or 10. I don't remember. You know, he was just saying that seriously. You know, literally, a lot of them have been deployed lots and lots of times. And, you know, I think it can relate to them more. And I was hoping that with the part of one of the things I hope with the book is just to, you know, make him a real soldier. He's not just a theorist, but he's also a soldier. And, you know, this is what he lived through, this through and lived for. It was very important to him to be a soldier and to be a successful one.
I thought another thing that I did not know about Clausewitz that I found very interesting and wanted to ask you, you know, how this experience worked for him and how that may have shaped his opinion, was he was actually a prisoner of war for a not insignificant period of time. How did that happen, and did that experience manifest itself in any of his writings?
I don't know that I could say that it you know, comes across in any of his writings, but how this happened is in the 1806 campaign when Prussia and when France goes to war with Prussia, that he is captured at the end of this campaign after the Battle of Prenzlau, a fight around Prenzlau, and he was at the Battle of Jena famously, and they had this very rigorous 14-day fighting retreat afterward, where they fight a numerous number of actions, and eventually his unit is forced to surrender because it's just under so much pressure, you know, from the French. And what's interesting about his prisoner of war experience are a couple things that show us about him, and one, that the difference of the era that he's in. You know, he's sent to France as a prisoner, and he, at the time, he's essentially an adjutant or a staff officer or attached officer to Prince August, who's related to the Prussian royal family. Now, when Americans think of prisoners of war, we often think of Andersonville, or we think of, you know, the old William Holden movie, Stalag 17, or something like that. They put them in a nice place on the suburbs of Paris, in Soissons, not far from Paris. And, you know, he's a Prussian prince, so and in this period, you could just simply give your word that you were not going to participate in any political or military activities, and you would have a lot of freedom to do what you wanted. And so they would go to Paris and go to the museums and go to the plays, and eventually they go to Switzerland. They end up in this salon of Madame de Stael. And so that is his experience as a prisoner of war, and it's something he whines about, you know, constantly, you know, writes about, complains to Marie, who later becomes his wife, that, well, you know, this isn't what I want to do. The war with Prussia, between Prussia and France, is still going on, And in his mind, he's missing an opportunity to make a name for himself, because he desperately wanted to make a name for himself as a soldier. And if you're sitting as a prisoner in France and in the museum, you're not getting the opportunity, because in his view, you had to be in the field. You had to make a name for yourself in battle. And that was really critical to him. And he's very ambitious, and in a military state, that's how you get to the top, is by being successful as a soldier.
You know, one of the things that also hit me in the book was that I guess I probably knew and forgot, or maybe I never knew. Take your pick on this one, but the effect of the French Revolution on everything in Europe. I mean, you covered really well, nicely in the book about how that changed virtually everything in Europe. I mean, before, wars had been fought, king to king, and their armies were relatively small, and they would meet in the certain patterns or you know, almost like a chess game. But the revolution, can you talk a little bit about the revolution in France, how that changed war in general, how that changed Clausewitz?
Yeah, we date modern, or a lot of historians date modern, quote-unquote modern history, from the French Revolution in 1789, because it did just so utterly overturn so many different things, politically, militarily, you know, socially, and exactly like you said, the methods and intensity, the intensity and the scale in particular of warfare changed. And Clausewitz as a teenager, preteen even, you know, is involved in this. And the French Revolution, one of the things the French revolutionaries did that made them so dangerous to the other states is that they were able to harness the passions of the people, as Clausewitz calls it. The people had been kind of pushed to the side in warfare in the pre-1789 regimes, but what the French revolutionaries did, they eventually did, was they harnessed the people. The people were brought into the picture. They build a mass army, and they resort to a form of almost universal conscription, and they build very, very large armies. They're partially forced to do this because they end up at war with so many different countries at the same time. But also, they are very serious about protecting and exporting their revolution. And they fight a lot more than the armies had before, and this was, you know, a wake up call for a lot of the other countries in Europe. They have the ability to fight more. They have the ability to fight more often. They have larger armies to do it with, and they aren't bound by any particular doctrine or ideas. And they're willing to innovate. And you have a system that rises up in the French army where the old way of advancement goes. And if you're good enough, particularly under Napoleon, he of course rises out of this. If you're good enough, you know, and keep from getting killed, and it can be successful if the revolutionaries themselves don't kill you, you can rise to the very, very top of the ranks. And Napoleon comes out of this, and the success that he had builds on this evolving system, harnesses it, refines it, with his own genius and his own just, you know, raw determination. You know, Clausewitz calls him the most determined general the world had ever seen. This is what he harnesses to make himself so successful. The other countries are then forced to change the way they do business. Their armies get larger. They move to some types of conscription. And Clausewitz is very much involved in this, this reform movement after 1806 in Prussia, and then the second round of it, you know, after 1812 as well, trying to bring the Prussian subject to get him more interested in the state, to build more faith in the state, to build this patriotism and nationalism that they see that has arisen among the French. Other countries want to do this as well, and Clausewitz helps build this new army after 1806, and again to build a larger Prussian army after 1812 and 1813 as well.
You mentioned earlier that in the 19th century and before then, it wasn't uncommon for an officer to serve multiple nations. Indeed, especially in the Napoleonic period, his name slips my mind, but one of the Dutch field marshals, he fought on both sides during the course of the war. But Karl Clausewitz served in the Russian army for 2 years. Not all Prussian officers, you know, ran off to and continued to fight from Russia. What drove him to want to go to Russia and serve at Russia, and what were the events that enabled him to return back to service at Prussia?
Yeah, well, in 1812, the Prussians are essentially, after 1806, Napoleon essentially dismembers, about half of Prussia. And he eventually, by 1812, he has essentially forced the Prussians into an alliance with France. And in 1812, of course, famously, Napoleon invades Russia, and he forces Prussia to, and some other countries, a lot of other countries, obviously, to help him do this. Clausewitz very much hates the French, hates Napoleon, hates his politics, admires his military skill, and wonders at it, but at the same time, he's unwilling himself to fight alongside Napoleon, even under the Prussian flag. And there were several dozen other Prussian, often high rank, well, usually mid-grade and sometimes high-ranking officers that felt the same way. And a lot of them resigned or stepped down from positions. And a number of them, including Clausewitz, went to Russia in 1812. He resigned in a particularly spectacular fashion, writing this very long and in many ways an attack on the, in some parts of it is certainly an attack on the way the Prussian system works. And so it doesn't do as, it doesn't help him a lot with a lot of the Prussian aristocracy and with the king himself. It makes it difficult for him to get back in to the Prussian army later on. But he will go to Russia in 1812, and some of the other some other Prussian officers with him take various different jobs. But this 1812 campaign, this is one of the more famous things of the Napoleonic period. If people know anything about Napoleonic period and Napoleonic wars, they've usually heard of 1812 campaign, and they've usually heard of the Waterloo campaign. And Clausewitz is involved in this 1812 campaign from the day it begins until the day it ends, and it's very critical in his life. It almost kills him a couple of times because of the exposures of it. And he writes about his teeth falling out and his hair falling out, and he almost freezes to death. He's exhausted a lot from it, and he has a horse shot out for him in one example. But he sees he goes here also. Part of it is, he sees here a chance again for him to make a name for himself. The problem is getting himself put in the right position to make a name for himself. He doesn't speak Russian, so he's not going to get a command, so he wanders around from several different staffs from time to time, but he spends a lot of his time fighting in rear guard units, and because here, again, was where the combat is where you can make a name for himself, and he's always very ambitious, but he's involved all the way from the Russian march from the beginning of the war, when they're retreating and marching deeper in, all the way to Moscow. He helped actually plan part of one of the Russian armies, its route of retreat, initially in the war, because he was on one of the staffs, and he fights at the Battle of Borodino, one of the bloodiest battles of the Napoleonic period, one of the bloodiest one-day battles that happens during this period. He's lucky that he's out of the main action for most of that, but he is involved in it. He sees the burning of Moscow, which of course is one of the most famous. His unit is the rear guard. That's one of the last units that marches through Moscow, and he listens to the conversation from where Russian is negotiating with the French military officers about whether or not they'll take the city intact, and there's some, he sees this, observes this, records it. Then he eventually gets posted to a command for a while, where when the war is changed and Napoleon is retreating, Clausewitz sees the aftermath of the crossing of the Berezina, which is famous for just the horrendous experience of particularly of the French armies there, and it's 20 below zero, and he writes some very disturbing letters, actually, where he observes the what happens after that. But most importantly, as far as his contribution, is what happens at the very end of this campaign. He goes to Russia, and in the other campaigns, he wants to make a name for himself as a soldier. But what he does, arguably the most important thing he accomplishes in his life, he accomplishes here at the end of the campaign, because he convinces the Prussian corps that is supporting Napoleon's invasion. He's one of the people that helps convince it to change sides. And this provokes a change in Prussia, and Prussia will eventually, from this, change sides in the war. And you will see a shift in the alliance system in Europe that will develop, and in another war against Napoleon, result of this. And he's very much involved in the in now making Prussia an instrument in fighting this war. So there's a lot that happens to him in the Russian campaign.
Long before he gets to Russia, I mean, normally the Prussian military officers were not particularly well educated, I gather from your book. And where is, I mean, he was not of an upper crust family. Where does he get, I mean, how does he get this education? How does he get so devoted to taking notes about all these battles he's in and start writing the, you know, the, or setting the groundwork for what becomes On War?
Well, he doesn't have much of an education as a child, and when you go in the Army at the age 11 or 12, depending on who you believe about his birth date, doesn't give you much time to get any education. But he's very fortunate after the War of the First Coalition that he ends up posted at a place where there's a library or a library nearby for a short time, and he just reads voraciously. And then his next commander after that is a gentleman who's very much interested in the education of his officers and his men, and even the men's families. And he has a garrison school and has courses for his officers, and Clausewitz does as much as he can there. And from that, he gets himself appointed to an officer training school in Berlin, which is critical because here is where he meets Scharnhorst and comes, you know, basically Scharnhorst becomes one of his mentors, and his education from that, you know, is critical. And he reads like everything, you know, everything he can get his hands on, particularly on military affairs. He reads memoirs, histories, you know, and so on, but also a lot of art, reads a lot about art, literature, reads a lot of literature. His letters with his wife, they're filled with discussions of art, architecture, novels, you know, and so on. So it was just an incessant, voracious reading, you know, does it as well. And this gives him a very good foundation for analysis. And he starts writing very early on, which is, you know, everybody knows Clausewitz for On War, which is, of course, the most important work. But he very early on, starts, even when he's 23, 24, 25 years old, you know, he starts writing this book called Strategy that he never finishes, and this is based upon, you know, his study of other works, and in some ways his reaction to what he sees as bad theory in some of these other things that he's reading. But also he writes an enormous amount of history, you know, studies of campaigns, and throughout his life he's always writing studies of the campaigns he is in and examining the campaigns of others, Frederick the Great, you know, the Duke of Brunswick, others. You know, so it's just this constant intellectual drive to write theory, to write history, to write about politics. And, you know, he even writes some things on art, architecture, you know, in particular, very little, but some. And a lot of his stuff hasn't survived, so we don't know everything that he actually did write. But it's astounding what has survived, the volume of it, when you consider that, you know, I guess it's scratched out with a quill pen. So...
And let's touch on his work here for a minute. You mentioned her name earlier on the show, and I definitely think we should talk about her a bit. Cause, again, one of those interesting tidbits that you've helped bring out into the light is Clausewitz didn't know that he was going to be Clausewitz. He passed away before all that could happen. And
yeah,
if it wasn't for one particular woman, we wouldn't know Clausewitz was Clausewitz either. Talk for a bit about Marie and what she did in order to make sure that his intellectual legacy was carried forward.
Yeah, Marie von Bruhl, who, you know, becomes his wife after a 7-year courtship. When they first met in 1803, her mother was not particularly enthralled with, you know, her daughter marrying a very poor, very junior officer with questionable credentials, questionable future, questionable background, no land, no money. So it takes them 7 years to wear her down, you know, essentially to where Madame von Bruhl will actually bend and say, okay, you know, you guys can get married. You know, once Clausewitz has a little rank and has made a little better, a little progress in his career, she becomes more amenable. But Marie is really critical because she is the driving force beyond getting his stuff published. After when Clausewitz dies in the cholera epidemic, she's a year or so later, she starts publishing you know, his works. Would we have had it otherwise? Who knows? I mean, we might have. Someone else might have published it, but she's certainly instrumental in that. She's also instrumental when he's actually writing on war and writing some of his other things. He worked closely with her. How closely? You know, it's difficult to tell. There's a lady named Vanya Ettinger who's writing a book. Bellinger, who is writing a book on Marie now. So I think in a year or two she'll probably finish with that, and that'll give us, I think, a better picture of just how much she helps with his ideas. You know, I've read a lot of her letters. She's a very, very bright woman, very sharp, very knowledgeable, very well educated, always involved in politics. And her family was always very much involved in politics as well. Her father had died before Clausewitz came on the scene, but he held a number of really high-ranking military and political positions in the Prussian kingdom. So the family's very well connected and related to a lot of the other, you know, critical leadership in Prussia during Clausewitz's time. So Vanya will tell us, hopefully in her book, how much, really even a better idea of her impact.
Well, as he's going along his career, I mean, he starts out, and I think you described it pretty well, he's a 12-year-old kid in combat, a 13-year-old kid in combat, a 14-year-old ensign, is that right, in combat. I mean, you know, he goes through all these combat situations, and yet he's gathering all this combat experience. He's also thinking about, as he goes along, what he's seen. At what point does he begin to apply some of his theories in the positions that he succeeds to as he moves up the food chain?
Well, that's a difficult question. I haven't thought about that one. Probably probably the first chance he gets to do it in a combat situation is certainly with, you know, in 1812 in Russia, you know, and then later on in 1813 he's actually involved in some of the planning for that, and in 1813-1814 he essentially the chief of staff to a corps in the 1814 campaign. It's certainly all the training that he's had as a staff officer and all the studying that he's done of battles and done of various campaigns would certainly, you know, be there. And you see some of his letters from 1814, some of the ideas that he's talking about, you know, in some senses are actually, you know, a little bit here and there about are starting to arise. But maybe even before that, when he's involved in the reforms of the Prussian army in 1807 to 1812, boy, it's a difficult thing to think about. I mean, certainly he's involved with so many people that are thinking about so many different things and experimenting with so many different ideas in the reform movement and the organizing the army and trying to get reorganize Prussia itself to make it a stronger state and more able to fight a better war. I would think certainly that the reading and intensity of his study is feeding into that as well.
It's sometimes said in a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek, but in many ways it's accurate, especially from an American perspective. Besides his couple of years with Russia, he was a Prussian. He was a patriotic Prussian. But Prussia as a state that, you know, eventually united all of Germany, in many ways it could be, especially in his formative years, it was almost an army with a state, vice the American context. A state that happens to have an army. Is that, you know, Clausewitz's understanding of the military political interaction being such a different context than the modern Western mind? Are there some things in his writing that maybe get misinterpreted simply because of the context of the political reality that he lived in, vice where we are in our modern day representative republic?
Whew, that's a tough one there. I mean, his ideas are often, I think, you know, one of the jokes about Clausewitz is that his ideas are always misunderstood, and he gets accused, for example, he gets accused by Liddell Hart and others that World War One is fought as badly as it's fought because of Clausewitz's ideas, which is, you know, arguably it's fought exactly the opposite of the way Clausewitz would have said it was fought. Is it worth the object that you're going after here? What is the object? I don't know. I think there's sometimes an apprehension that, yes, because he is a Prussian and that he is from a military state, that, you know, is this a bad thing to be studying. And you know, one of the criticisms sometimes leveled at his work is that book on war, but then he writes so many other things as well. It's bad just to narrow it to that. But one of the criticisms sometimes leveled on war is that it doesn't really make a moral argument for war. You know, it's his effort is to understand it and how to think about it. But you know, the impression, you know, modern, you know, postmodern Western world war is obviously, you know, in the postmodern view, often depicted as nothing but bad. It's always something you shouldn't do, no matter what, sometimes. And but to someone of Clausewitz's age, particularly someone who's a professional officer, you know, his view that war is a political tool is certainly ingrained in his work, and certainly we have we think about it that way very often as well, but not always. But you know, he doesn't approach it as being whether it's right or wrong, merely as an is. I mean, he's not certainly advocating for it, but he's saying, look, the reality is this happens. You know, this is what's going on. And in his age, I mean, this warfare is almost constant. Some of these, you know, the French are, and the British are essentially, you know, involved year after year after year in wars. And so during this period, so it's a little bit of a different, you know, mindset and a different attitude. And with it, it's always important when we teach theory in our classes, we always try to put the context to the students, because I think it helps to understand it a little better and help to clarify a little better sometimes what they're saying. Because part of the problem is when we approach, you know, Clausewitz's work or Sun Tzu, we have sometimes certain preconceptions based upon our own experience and upon our own society, and I think it helps understanding, look, you know, this is, they view things a little differently. This is maybe why they say this, and not necessarily why we think they say it, but they have their own motivations and their own context and own history that they're thinking about here. The conditions under which they have to operate is sometimes why they say such things. And sometimes it has to do with the technology, too, especially if you get down into the nitty-gritty, some of the aspects of why they fight some of the battles and things like this the way they do. A lot of it's determined by the weapons. And you know, it's not necessarily because they don't know what they're doing or because they're making bad decisions, but the way they do things forces them to do it this way.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned Sun Tzu, because one of my questions down the road was, there seem to be a lot of parallels in the study of war that Sun Tzu came up with, or at least what we've received, and what Clausewitz has come down with. Is that just my perception? Am I off base on that, or are they, in fact, very closely knit in some ways?
I think in some ways they're more alike than different. You know, other people would obviously argue against that, and you could build a good argument against it. But in some ways they are more alike than different. About 2 years ago, one of my students pointed out a great similarity. He says, we use On War, which isn't finished, and we use Sun Tzu, which we don't have a complete copy of. And people even argue if he actually existed. You know, his question was, why is this course built upon two books that aren't finished and are sometimes contradictory? And I said, okay, you're right. Yeah. I thought that was great. You know? So, but I think one of the big things where they're similar is they, for both of them, they get at that countries have certain, particularly when they're fighting wars or any time, but they have certain elements of national power that matter, that force should be directed against, and there are certain reasons why you do this, certain reasons you don't. Like, for example, you know, both Clausewitz and Sun Tzu talk about the importance of allies and how critical this is and how critical they are. And the problems with them as well when you're fighting a war. If you can separate someone from their allies, this is a good thing. It's a way to get to war. They both understand the importance of the enemy's army and the issues with dealing with this and how critical this is. They both understand, you know, how serious a war is and don't have any illusions about what you're getting yourself into. You know, Clausewitz writes, you know, like war is violence untrammeled. You know, it's a duel on a larger scale and so on. I mean, you know, things like that. He's putting across to the reader saying, look, this is serious business, a serious bloody business. You know, this is not a game. People are going to die. Things are going to be very bad, and it's going to be hard. Understand this when you get into it. You know, Sun Tzu says essentially a similar thing to the king when he warns the king. You know, look, when you go to war, it's going to cost you a lot of money. People are going to get angry. People are going to die. don't do this because you're angry. You better have a good reason for doing this, and you better understand the stakes, and you better understand that there can be a disaster here if you don't do this right. So there are certainly a lot of similarities there. One difference that is sometimes, you know, brought out, and there's people that can argue this either way, but there's stress on intelligence, you know, gathering of intelligence and the use of it. You know, with Sun Tzu, this is critical. Arguably, this is the primary thing his theory depends upon to make it work. It's certainly very important. Clausewitz, in his book on war, and in sections of it, he's very, very critical of intelligence and very skeptical of it, you know, particularly battlefield intelligence, it's argued. But there are other places in the book where he talks about assessment and understanding the enemy. So he obviously thinks there's some value to it, but sometimes he's very skeptical about it as well. So there's argument among people who study the book about what is going on here. Now, as far as you mentioned earlier about experience directly related to the book, and you know, I think that his overall experience feeds on war, but in this particular, and again, I don't think you can draw a complete comparison between one incident that happens to him to an idea in the book, but I think often his experience, you know, as a staff officer and the guy handling the intelligence and his combat experience makes him a bit cynical, and because of the bitterness of it, especially in regard to intelligence. Again, proving this is, you know, absolutely is impossible. But in December of 1813, when he's he's simply the chief staff officer for a corps commanded by a man named von Molden, they are helping invade what essentially was Danish territory, a northern part of Germany. And they get involved in a battle at a little town called Sehestedt. And here they're just pummeled by the Danish army. You know, they have about five or six, Clausewitz's unit or his corps, they have about 500 or 600 men killed, and they're pushed out of the town and pushed back across the river. And he writes a letter afterward, and he says, all the intelligence had told us the Danes weren't there. You know, so, and this is an example where, okay, yeah, he says in the book that intelligence is bad. Okay, did it ever happen to him in real life? Well, yes, we know on at least one occasion that he had the intelligence reports on where the enemy is supposed to be, and they're completely wrong, and that they paid a blood price, you know, a very serious one, you know, in this, you know, because the intelligence was wrong. You know, so is that a direct relation? I don't know. It's hard to say, but there are examples of it. So.
Yeah, we all have our favorite intel weenie jokes to tell.
I love telling that to the intelligence officers in my class. They always get a kick out of that. Yeah, so
they have their own heritage, whether it's proud or not, is subject to debate. Moving a couple thousand years up for other strategists to talk about, there was a contemporary of Clausewitz that had a big influence on the 19th century U.S. military. That was the Franco-Swiss Russian. I think he actually lived in Belgium for a while, too.
Yeah.
Antoine Jomini, if I'm pronouncing
yeah.
that correctly.
Yeah, I heard
and
it pronounced
often,
different ways. Most Americans will pronounce it Jomini or Jomini.
And he was reached renown and was heavily studied before Clausewitz's star ever started to rise. And it's often said that because he was so influential with the U.S. military in the 19th century, that the ideas of Antoine Jomini from the Napoleonic Wars, in many ways, because of his influence on our general officers that fought on both sides of our Civil War, that it led to the bloodbath and the hundreds of thousands of dead that it was. Is that really a fair critique of Antoine Jomini? And having looked at Clausewitz and the differences between him and Antoine, if Clausewitz had been the one everybody studied before the Civil War as opposed to Jomini, would it really have made that much of a difference?
That's a long, complicated question.
Yeah, but it's somebody's dissertation, so you know, take a couple of decades.
Yeah, the Jomini issue, you know, I think sometimes Jomini's maligned unfairly. Having read a lot of his work, I mean, one thing that is forgotten is he wrote so much, you know, just an astounding number of works under various different titles, and His histories are very good, the ones that I've read. I haven't read them all, obviously, but some of them that I've read are very good. And, you know, I think that his theory is worth reading. I think that his approach overall, Jomini's approach overall, is more operational, what we would define as operational today, and a lot of it is more tactical than what we would define, the way we would define it today. Now, I think he sometimes does talk about what we would define as a strategic realm today, and sometimes, just like Clausewitz, what he's talking about when he talks about strategy, he's mixing, you know, strategy, the strategic realm, and the operational realm, you know, at the same time. They both do that. They became rivals intellectually with their writings back and forth, and they both take shots at each other, you know, insult each other a little bit in their writings. And Jomini was certainly more influential because he was translated earlier into English, I think, and also because he was in French, and a lot of American officers, particularly at West Point, some of the other guys were taught French. And plus he was considered the interpreter of Napoleon, and of course that was the man you studied in the 19th century. You know, because for obvious reasons, if you were a soldier, you studied Napoleon. As far as impact on the Civil War is interesting, you know, question, because that's always something debated by Civil War historians. How much impact does Jomini actually have? And some people accuse him of being their, you know, Clausewitz is branded as being the father of the slaughter of the Western Front unfairly, and I think Jomini is branded unfairly being for some problems of the Civil War. I don't think his influence is as strong as some would argue. From writing the book on the Civil War, you know, he has an influence on Halleck. You know, certainly Halleck translated Jomini's, you know, five-volume, one of the Union generals, Union general in chief for a while, and an important Union general, Halleck. He translated a lot of Jomini's work. But I remember comparing one of his translations of something that Halleck wrote his own book on theory based upon one of Jomini's books on theory. And I remember comparing, you know, what Halleck was saying versus what Jomini was writing. And I would say, this guy, Halleck, he didn't really understand what Jomini is saying here, was my conclusion. And having read a lot of Halleck's letters when I wrote my Civil War book, I would say he doesn't really get what Jomini is saying a lot of times, was my conclusion with it. So I think Jomini's got, sometimes things are hung on him that it's not his fault for. And so I don't think he has as big an impact on the Civil War as itself. Now, proving that's tough. But I think he has more of an impact on Civil War historians than he had on the Civil War generals, most of them. You know, so, but I could be wrong on that. He simply influenced Beauregard, because, you know, in the South as well, because he's a student of Jomini. But is that for good or ill? It's a different matter.
So. Well, I think one of the interesting things I got from your book was that I get, maybe it's because Clausewitz is hard to read. He wasn't really brought into the U.S. Training education for war officers until the 1940s. I mean, is that just because he was so hard to read, or because he was German, or so long for him to catch on?
Yeah, some would argue. I mean, some certainly are reading it. Eisenhower apparently read On War three times. Some I've seen written. Really, he doesn't. I don't think he really starts to get taught in American staff college and so on. Actually, until the 70s, even. Part of it has to do, I think there's just not as much interest of, but part of it, why we start to study him is because it's kind of a reaction to the Vietnam War and Harry Summers and others starting to look for, you know, explanations as to, you know, the American disaster there. What is it that we got wrong? And, you know, he famously writes this book on strategy. Some would argue about the validity of his interpretation of Clausewitz, but his willingness to explore becomes critical. And, you know, you've got Peter Perret's and Michael Howard's translation, which appears, you know, in the early 70s as well, On War, which is wonderful and is a standard text everywhere for places that teach this. And, you know, I think what's important about their translation, I think sometimes forgotten, and sometimes I try to point this out to my students here, you not only have know, Perret is, of course, brilliant, and Howard as well, wonderful historians in their own right. But these two gentlemen are also veterans of the Second World War, and, you know, Michael Howard won the Military Cross, you know, I think in Italy, and different people pronounce the name different ways. I'm not exactly sure of the pronunciation, but he's a veteran of the New Guinea campaign. So it's not only two guys who are two of the foremost historians of German history and German military history that are translating this text, but it's also two guys who are veterans of the Second World War that have real, you know, real military experience that, you know, certainly that context, that certainly, to me, can't hurt, you know, in their approach to it. You know, but it's certainly become the standard thing today in strategic studies courses. You know, you will get taught usually Clausewitz in some form, shape, or fashion. You know, in some parts of it, at least on war.
Well, you know, I think also you pointed out that things like the Weinberg Doctrine, which some people may remember, which kind of shades into the Powell Doctrine, but some of that is derived from Clausewitz. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, the people that look at that say that particularly what's important about Weinberger's, you know, the old Secretary of Defense under Reagan, the approach is that really understanding, you know, what your political objective is, what you want, making sure it's within the interest of the state to get it, you know, and, you know, making sure you bring enough force to bear to get it. And, you know, Weinberger, you know, doctrine is, you know, partially as a result of the feuding between the Doves and the Hawks, and partially a result of the feuding between the Doves and the Hawks in the Reagan administration. They're looking for some type of clarity and some type of measure for foreign policy, and say, well, how do we know when to intervene? You know, should we intervene in a place? What's some kind of reasoning and methodology that we can use for doing this? And, you know, making sure that it isn't with the interest of the United States, making sure it's something you can achieve with military force, making sure the people are behind it, making sure the Congress will actually support you. Now, you can see this is all very clearly a reaction, you know, to the war in Vietnam, you know, and making sure that you don't repeat what it was in their view some of the mistakes that the Johnson and Nixon administrations had made about, and Kennedy administration as well, about getting involved in Vietnam and deepening the American involvement there and not maintaining the support, you know, of the American people for the conflict there.
Now, we've talked about how we study Clausewitz, and I know the Germans study him, because it's funny that you mentioned translations, because when I served with a bunch of Europeans, I had both the Dutch and a German officer tell me that the Americans' problem with Clausewitz is our translations are lousy, and it didn't do me any good, because the only thing worse than my German is my Dutch, so I just had to take the word on it. But we also know that the rising power, actually, sorry, economically, it's already risen and gone a little bit past us. We know the Chinese have been studying Mahan quite a bit. And question I have for you is Clausewitz's influence from a military perspective, you know, global as we see it in the American and perhaps Western European context, or is his influence strictly limited, at least to a significant degree, with Western militaries? And kind of a corollary to that, if the Chinese are studying up on their Mahan, are they also studying up on their Clausewitz as opposed to their Mao?
You know, as far as what the Chinese are teaching, I couldn't actually address that specifically because I don't know. But I know historically Mao Zedong, the founder of the communist state, I mean, he was very much a student of Clausewitz and Jomini, you know, and others, and his ideas. I mean, he steals from this what he thinks is best, and he integrates this. And, you know, almost everyone, you know, that looks at military affairs now there and that studies and learns about and plans, you know, most of them are going to read Clausewitz's work in some fashion. As one of the criticisms leveled at Clausewitz sometime is that he's obsolete. It's this 19th century work, and this is the age of the non-state actor and the terrorist organization. And, you know, Hugh Strawn points out in one of his books that a copy of On War was found in an Al-Qaeda safe house in Afghanistan, and the parts about personal courage were highlighted. You know, so which tells you, okay, is this worth studying? Well, your enemy is studying it, so thus it is worth studying. It's a pretty logical conclusion to make at that point. So I mean, there's certainly theory, you know, Clausewitz himself said, you know, theory, you know, has to be realistic, can't be caught in hair-splitting flights of fancy. If it's not realistic theory and it's not good theory, if it's not theory that lasts the test of time, then throw it out, get rid of it. I mean, we certainly should apply his own test to his own work, and if there are parts of it that have been developed as being obsolete, then certainly, you know, look the other way with it. But, you know, all of it shouldn't be thrown out because maybe one particular, you know, passage is perhaps not as relevant today as it was 200 years ago. You know, when you look at his larger ideas, that's the real thing that matters.
You know? Well, one of the things that struck me was that Clausewitz seems to be more of a guide or a philosophy than than a cookbook, and I'm sure that frustrates a lot of people who are looking for that.
Yeah.
Well, I want to check item B and item C. But I wanted to, there was some nitpicking going on here recently with the translation. I see that Jim Holmes from the Naval War College wrote a piece on how we've always misunderstood Clausewitz because of the translation error. And it has to do with that famous quote about war is an extension of policy by other means or you know, and Jim goes off on this thing. It's not by other means, but it basically includes other means, and you're not done just because you go to war. The politics continues. Is that a tempest in a teapot, or is there something more to that?
I don't know exactly what he said, so I wouldn't want to comment on it. But there are a lot of criticisms leveled at the translation. My suggestion is, one, if you don't like the Howard and Parade translation, go read one of the other ones and compare the translations, you know. But also, you know, I find, you know, people criticize, you know, the Parade and Howard translation. I'm like, Parade grew up in Germany and he's a native speaker. Okay. I mean, so his grasp of the language is probably fairly good, you know. So, I mean, you know, you can quibble certainly about things, but... Well, it's getting translations right is hard. Yeah, it's very difficult. Yeah.
Well, I have trouble translating.
I'm willing to give
trouble.
The native speaker the benefit of the doubt. Yes.
I have trouble understanding certain English words. So
yeah, me too.
That's,
yeah.
That's just the way it goes. Let's see. At what point in their careers should U.S. military officers or any military officer be looking at Clausewitz? I mean, is it too early when you're a second lieutenant or a butter bar ensign, or is it a thing for 03s and 04s and beyond?
You know, that is a hard one for me to answer. I've gone back and forth on that one myself over the years. You know, I've never been in the military, so I think asking someone who's been in the military and has studied it might be a better one. I've often thought it should be earlier, but then I think it may be later, and then I think maybe parts of it for different times depending on what your job is. So earlier is not bad, but I think then... You know, there's so much in On War that, my gosh, I mean, you know, and these other works as well, you know, the Principles of War that he, the little Principles of War book that he wrote for the Crown Prince, I mean, that should, to me, something that should be read very early on, but it's also something that can be profitably read, you know, years later, and a lot of his work, you know, is like that. It's not something that, one of the first reviewers of Clausewitz's book, he said, this is something that, not to be read, but to be studied, and that's, you know, that's the reality of it, I think. It's a book that you come back to. On War is something you can come back to over and over and see something new and see something new that you missed. There is a value. Or see something that you don't like now that you liked before, you know, which is certainly, I think, one of the great values of the text. I mean, like Thucydides, Clausewitz wanted to write a book that would, you know, in a sense, stand the test of time or be here a while, and he's kind of succeeded in doing so.
Yeah, I think that is one of the power of, you know, him, Sun Tzu, you mentioned Ulysses. It goes along the phrase I've often said that, you know, if you could reanimate Alexander the Great, you know, and let him know one of the courses of action is you can't kill everybody in the city automatically, that any challenge that we have in the 21st century, you know, these people, they would be able to sit for a minute, have it explained to it. You might have to explain to them some of the technological stuff. But the fundamentals really are timeless. They really don't change that much. And I know you've seen it as somebody who is an instructor, but it is very frustrating many times when somebody who is at a very senior position, we're talking, you know, general officers and flag officers, who are completely unaware of things that have gone before and have a flash of brilliance that you might stay in a sage whisper of, oh, geez, shouldn't you have known that a couple decades ago? And one subject we've had here on a regular basis is a conversation about education. You know, we talked about how, you know, Carl really wasn't what we would define as a well-educated man, per se. He was a professional soldier. But especially in the Navy, we emphasize to the point of drawing firm lines around it, I believe it's 80 or 85%, technological background, technological training, technocrats, at the expense of what we would call a well-rounded liberal arts education. Was back in Clausewitz's day, there really was no such thing as a technocrat. It was that study of history. And has the opinion today about the proper education, the intellectual education of our military leaders, whether it's at a lieutenant or above, is that where it needs to be, or do we still have significant gaps that need to be addressed?
Well, that's a big question. Not understanding the totality of the military education system, it'd be difficult for me to really say on that for today. I mean, it's, you know, certainly you pointed out that one of the main problems, the conditions are certainly different. The Navy certainly needs the technical education, you know, desperately when you're running aircraft carriers and ships and submarines, et cetera. And they didn't have to worry about that in Clausewitz's age, and when they could train the officers for, you know, very specifically to think about tactics, operations, strategy, logistics, you know, and so on. I think to Clausewitz, what seems to have been the most important thing, and this is something he gets directly from Scharnhorst, or certainly very much from Scharnhorst, is teaching people to think critically, to teach them to question things, but to analyze things and analyze rationally, see what the real guts of the problem are, see what the solution is. You know, don't necessarily be confined by it. And you know, I know the Navy seems to have started to make an effort to train kind of a Navy staff officer in a little bit of an effort. I'm not exactly sure how the transition or the development of going there. I know they've got a couple courses in Newport now related to that. But I don't know that it would be, you know, the Army has their SAMS course to train planners. And I've had some friends that have been through that course and had very, very good things to say about it and thought it was excellent, excellent preparation for them to go on and be on staffs and be operational planners and strategic planners and so on. And I don't know if the Navy has, you know, really gotten to having that yet. I'm not really sure, but it would be, I don't know the state of the course back in Newport, but because I haven't been back there in a while, but it would be interesting to see that. I think it couldn't hurt, you know, certainly. I don't know, you might know more about it than me.
Well, Don, we're running up on the end of the show here. I want to tell you that now on my Kindle I've got two of your books. The other was the some of the other papers are awfully expensive, even on Amazon.
Yes, extortionately.
But,
so
I've got your Civil War book. I've got this book on Clausewitz, and I'm trying to find out now, what are you going to be up to in the next few weeks and months, and what are we going to see from you next?
I honestly don't know. I've got a couple of translations of to help other people, you know, publish, but I'm not sure what we're going to do exactly, you know, with that. So I don't know. I've been so busy with this and just finally recovered from it. So.
Well, I certainly appreciate you joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And, Sal, you got another final question for Don?
No, just we really appreciate it, Don, and enjoy your time out there in Monterey, and we look forward to reading your stuff down the road.
Okay, well, thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate you having me on.
You got it. And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, we'll see you soon and hope you have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Irish Paddy O'd, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary, to the
Introducing Hardee's $5 All-Star Meals. Loaded with satisfying classics. For just $5, you get a charbroiled double cheeseburger, hot dog, and oh yeah, fries, drink, and a fresh baked cookie. Or a double cheeseburger, a spicy chicken sandwich, and what? The fries, drink, cookie thing again? Or hand-breaded tenders, and spoiler alert, fries, drinks, and cookies for days, y'all. All for just $5. The $5 All-Star Meals. Stop by Hardee's and get yourself one today. Price and participation may vary. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Tax not included. Look, at Hardee's, we think that if you're hungry and you have $5, you deserve a satisfying meal. Like one of our new $5 All-Star Meals, loaded with American classics like a charbroiled double cheeseburger, hot dog, fries, drink, even a warm cookie. But hey, if that's not your thing, you can always break out your degree in menu engineering, piece something together from the other guy's value menu. Or just swing by Hardee's, get yourself a real meal. The $5 All-Star Meals. There's no better way to spend $5. Price and participation may vary. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Tax not included.